Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, The Pope and the People. We bring you a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience, where he appealed for an end to attacks on places of worship after recent killings in Nigeria and the Central African Republic. The ultimate sacrifice at Auschwitz. We remember Saint Maximilian Kolbe, the priest who gave up his own life so a fellow prisoner could live. And all about the Assumption. We listened to a reflection from the former Procurator General of the Dominican Order about the importance of the Assumption and explore the history of this feast with an oblate of Mary Immaculate. Pope Francis has urged an end to attacks on places of worship after recent violence in Nigeria and the Central African Republic. He made the appeal at his Wednesday General Audience on August the 9th, where during his catechesis he spoke about God's mercy as the driving force of Christian hope. Devin Watkins reports.
Pope Francis appealed for an end to every form of hatred and violence, especially those perpetrated in places of worship where the faithful gather to pray. He was referring to an attack on Catholics attending Sunday Mass in southern Nigeria.
Sono rimasto molto addolorato dalla strage avvenuta domenica scorsa in Nigeria.
At his general audience, Pope Francis said he remains deeply saddened by the massacre, which took place last Sunday in Nigeria inside a church where innocent people were killed. At least 13 people were killed and 26 others were wounded when gunmen opened fire on worshippers at St. Philip's Catholic Church in Ozobulu, near the city of Onitsha. The Pope also decried an incident which occurred on Wednesday in the Central African Republic. He said, unfortunately, news has arrived this morning of violent homicides in the Central African Republic against the Christian community. He expressed his desire that attacks on places of worship should cease before leading the crowd in the recitation of the Hail Mary for those who had died.
Ave Maria, piena di grazia, il Signore con te.
In the catechesis portion of his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Francis spoke about God's mercy and forgiveness as the driving force or the motor of Christian hope. He reflected on the passage in Luke's Gospel in which Jesus forgives the sins of the woman who bathed his feet with her tears and a precious ointment. Pope Francis said that Jesus' merciful action causes scandal because it overturns the dominant attitude of his time. Jesus, he said, embraced sinners and the untouchables of his day rather than rejecting them as was commonplace.
Gesù davanti al dolore umano sente misericordia.
Jesus, when faced with human pain, feels mercy, he said. Jesus' heart is merciful. Jesus feels compassion. The Pope said Jesus' astonishing attitude to those in desperate situations, even those who have made many mistakes in life, marks our Christian identity with the stamp of mercy. And this, he said, gives a sure foundation to our hope. Pope Francis then invited all present to reflect on the cost of sin.
Gesù non va in croce perché sana i malati.
Jesus does not go to the cross because he heals the sick, preaches charity, or proclaims the Beatitudes, he said. The Son of God goes to the cross above all because he forgives sins and because he wants the total and definitive liberation of the human heart. Finally, Pope Francis said God's mercy both transforms us and renews our hope. We are all poor sinners, he said, in need of the mercy of God, who has the strength to transform us and to restore our hope every day. I'm Devin Watkins.
The Pope's sadness over the murder of 13 people at a Nigerian Catholic church was echoed by Archbishop Ignatius Kagame of Jos in central Nigeria. The Archbishop spoke to us of his shock and sadness on learning of the news and described the attack as inhuman and barbaric.
I heard the sad news of the attack on worshippers in the church of St. Philip in Ozobulu, which is in Newe Diocese of Anambra State in southeastern Nigeria. It's a very tragic news. This attack was terribly inhuman. This was targeted at people who had assembled in the early hours of the morning at 6 a.m. to worship God in the church. And this wicked man or person came in with the guns in order to kill. And they succeeded in killing, I'm told, over 11 people, and so many people were wounded and in critical condition. This is barbaric. This is inhuman. And we condemn it totally. And our thoughts and condolences to the good people of Newe Diocese, to Bishop Hilary Okeke, and to the good people who, despite all these attacks, continue to be strong Catholics, continue to be committed Christians, and are ready to show by life of witness that they are Christians, committed to Jesus.
That was Nigerian Archbishop Ignatius Kaigami of Jos. He's the patron saint of drug addicts, prisoners, the pro-life movement and families, who heroically sacrificed his own life in the Nazi concentration camp of Auschwitz so that another man could live. Polish-born conventual Franciscan priest Maximilian Kolbe was killed in Auschwitz on August the 14th, 1941. He had stood up and offered his own life because he was so moved by the plight of a fellow prisoner, a married man with a young family, who'd been chosen to die by the Nazis. Father James McCurry of the Franciscan Friars Conventual in the US is the author of a biography on Maximilian Kolbe. He was close friends with the man whose life was spared by the Nazis because of Father Kolbe's heroic act. He told me more about this inspirational saint.
Saint Maximilian Kolbe stood in the 20th century against the backdrop of all the cataclysms of the two world wars, the unfolding of Marxism into a whole communist totalitarian system, the rise of nationalism in Japan, where he was a missionary, the spread of secularism and totalitarianism. He stood as a symbol of gospel freedom against that backdrop of all the isms that were dehumanizing modern times. In late July 1941, whilst he was a prisoner of the Nazis at Auschwitz concentration camp, Maximilian and approximately 600 other prisoners from his barracks were lined up for the entire day in the glaring sun, and 10 of them were selected to be executed in reprisal for the escape of a fellow prisoner. Father Kolbe was not one of the 10, but one of the 10, Mr. Francis Gajewniczek, a Polish army sergeant, cried out, "What will happen to my wife and my children?" And Father Kolbe was so moved by the plight of this father of a family that he stepped forward and asked the commandant if he could take the place of Mr. Gajewniczek. The exchange was allowed, and all 10 were placed in an underground starvation bunker where they were deprived of food and water for the next 2 weeks. And when 4 of them were still alive after the fortnight, the Nazis executed them by the injection of carbolic acid into their veins. And that was on the 14th of August, 1941.
It's also very heartwarming that the man he gave up his life for managed to survive.
Yes, Mr. Gajewniczek thanked him with his eyes. I got to know Mr. Gajewniczek very well in the years after St. Maximilian Kolbe's canonization in 1982, and Mr. Gajewniczek lived until 1995, the age of 93. We became the best of friends, and he often would say that St. Maximilian Kolbe did not die just for him. He died for all of us to give us a witness of heroic charity.
We saw Pope Francis visit the Auschwitz death camp, and he remained in silent prayer for more than 10 minutes inside the cell where Father Kolbe was put to death. What were your feelings on watching this?
Watching Pope Francis praying in total silence within the death cell of Maximilian Kolbe at Auschwitz gave me a deep resonance in soul, because I've been inside that death cell many times myself with groups of Franciscan friars, with groups of lay people, and privately to pray. It reduces one to silence. The atmosphere in that cell is a sacred atmosphere because it proved to the fellow prisoners, it proved to me, to your listeners, it proved to Pope Francis that good can triumph over evil. A place that the Nazis designed to be a site of horror and hate and despair, Maximilian Kolbe, by the grace of God, turned into a place of the triumph of good and of love and of hope.
And I was speaking there to Father James McCurry, author of a biography on St. Maximilian Kolbe. Marked on August the 15th, the Solemnity of the Assumption celebrates the Blessed Virgin Mary being assumed into heaven and is the oldest Marian feast in the Church. Father Robert Ombres is the former Procurator General of the Dominican Order, and he shares with us this reflection on the wonder and importance of Mary's Assumption.
The feast of the Assumption of Mary, body and soul into heaven, is wonderful. It's wonderful and important in ways that perhaps we don't always appreciate. It's full of wonder, and it tells us something important about God, about Mary, and about ourselves. About God, the solemnity of the Assumption of Mary into heaven tells us how gracious, extraordinarily gracious in every sense, God is. How he, in his love, in his creativity, in his sustaining grace, made of Mary, in her freedom, in her response, such a choice and glorious example of what it means to be human. Today's solemnity of the Assumption tells us something important about Mary. This woman who was not touched by sin from the moment of her conception throughout her life. How her uniquely close biological bodily link to Jesus Christ was glorified in her assumption into heaven, body and soul. Which of course also means that her extraordinarily close spiritual relationship to Jesus Christ in faith is part of the meaning of her assumption. So she is assumed to be with Christ, the risen bodily Jesus Christ. She is assumed body and soul, she who was always so close to him, body and soul. And today's feast, finally, tells us something important about ourselves. It tells us where the fullness of our hope lies, not so much in being souls in heaven, but in being redeemed fully as persons who are body and soul, who will be resurrected to live with a resurrected Jesus Christ and the assumed Mary. The importance then of Mary and her assumption body and soul is also for us now, not just our hope for our future. It means that we must never despise or harm our bodies or our souls, and we must never despise or harm the bodies or souls of others. It is a wonderful feast with so much to be grateful to God for.
And that reflection came from Father Robert Ombres, Dominican priest. But how far back can we trace the history of the Feast of the Assumption, and what further light does the event shed on the figure of Our Lady? To find out more details, I sat down with Father Clyde Rausch, a priest from the missionary Oblates of Mary Immaculate Order.
It goes back to the 6th century, and it's the oldest feast of Mary in the church, so it goes back quite a way. But the name in the original in the East was the Sleeping of Mary. Mary sleeping.
Yes, the Dormition. But I mean, in fact, some church fathers believe that she was still alive and sleeping when she was taken up to heaven, and others believe that it happened after she died. I mean, there's still an open debate on that, isn't there?
Yes, we don't have to believe even that Mary died. That's not part of the dogma. The dogma is that she was taken up to heaven, body and soul. That in 1950, Pius XII made it a dogma.
In some ways, it's surprising that it's so recent, you know, given, as you say, it's such an old feast.
Well, the Orthodox, they don't like this, the dogma pronounced in 1950, because it says, they say it goes back to apostolic times. There's no reason to define this. It is always in the tradition of the church, starting with John receiving the responsibility of Mary at the foot of the cross. And then it seems that she was with John when she died, and probably in Jerusalem. So there's a question about a tomb. There are two tombs of Mary, but one of the emperors of Rome, of the Roman Empire, wanted the body of Mary. And then he was just told there is no body of Mary. Well, they opened up the tomb in Jerusalem, and there wasn't anything. But there was the history is that either she died in Ephesus or in Jerusalem, but mostly Jerusalem.
Do we know who fixed the date of August the 15th and why?
That was an early thing. Now I forget the exact reason for August the 15th, but that goes way back also. In the Orthodox, you have the different calendar. So it's the 19th or the 15th, but it was always in August.
As you said, it's always been a more important feast for the Eastern churches, right? I mean, that's still so to this day, isn't it?
Yes, it started already in the 6th, 7th century, and in the 12th century they were celebrating here in Rome the Feast of the Assumption. So it's been in the church, but it began in the East, but of course at that time the East and the West were one, so there was not a distinction.
Can you tell us anything about some of the most important or colourful festivals that come to your mind in honour of Mary's Assumption that are celebrated in countries around the world?
I don't know how actually they celebrate it in the East, the Dormition of Mary. Every religious order in the church has taken on this. It's also a holiday for us. We're missionary oblates of Mary Immaculate. But the exact way is simply remembering in the West that the body is sacred and is and will also be resurrected on the last day for us, as we see it. But in the Orthodox, they see it as already at the beginning.
Can you share with us some of the most beautiful prayers associated with the Assumption liturgy?
The prayers are very simple. The prayers are simply thanking God. God has fulfilled this in advance for Mary, what's to come for all of us, that ourselves, our persons, our body and soul, will also be taken into heaven in our own day at the last judgment.
Let's look now a little bit more closely at the figure of Mary herself and what we learn about her role and her character from the gospel accounts. Can you share with us your view?
The gospel account, of course, that this feast is taken from is John receiving the responsibility of Mary at the foot of the cross, and he takes over this. But the image that I like personally, because I'm interested in icons, you have the Pietà as Jesus died and he's taken down from the cross. The image is she's holding Jesus. And that's a very powerful image. In the Dormitians icons, in that scene, you have Mary sleeping or dying, and it's Jesus holding Mary in his arms. He's taking Mary up to heaven. In the West, in the Western Church, we have this great paintings of Mary being assumed into heaven. You see her floating up to heaven.
Surrounded by angels.
Yeah. But in the Dormition, you have Jesus himself receiving Mary. And this is an image that it's mutual. She's receiving Jesus from taking down from the cross, and then Jesus is receiving her. One of the things of my experience, if I can, may share this, in Sweden, there was a time in the church when everything was Jansenism. We were sinful and we can't do anything right. The Lutherans told me, at least you had Mary. As an image of faith, in the Lutheran church in Sweden, they never did away with the statues, the images of Mary. In fact, the best artists have produced images of Mary that are just fantastic. And it's for the Lutheran population.
That's surprising, too, because as we know, her importance in the church is not shared with many Protestants. For instance, the Assumption of Mary, because it's not explicitly mentioned in the Bible, it's not such an important feast day for them, is it?
No, this would not be. But the one of January 1st, of Mary. In Sweden, we had a Pentecostal minister because it was church unity. We shared thoughts in each one's pulpits. And we invited this Pentecostal minister to speak about Mary. Now, he came and gave the most beautiful homily, or we can't call it homily in the Catholic Church because he wasn't preaching, but sharing on Mary. It was original and from the heart. So he says, we've lost something here. He said that. And he was the Pentecostal minister that I know. And so Mary is an attractive figure. Salvation Army person came to me once and he had a rosary. He says, is it okay if I say the rosary? He says, I know it's only your Catholics can do that. But he says, I've been saying the rosary. Maybe I don't have permission to say the rosary. But he says, is it okay? I says, of course it's okay. So there is an undercurrent of devotion to Mary, even in other groups. But for some reason, because of their own traditions, they've had to almost say that Catholics adore Mary or worship Mary.
So what for you is Mary's greatest gift to the church, you know, her figure, her importance, everything about her?
For me, it's the scripture passage where she kept all these things inside, in her heart. She pondered these things in her heart. She was keeping these things in her heart, which she couldn't really totally understand, but gradually through the events of her life, they became clear. And for me, she tells us, bring it into yourselves. Jesus will, through the Spirit, reveal what this is supposed to mean for you personally. And I think this is what Mary did. You know, so her witness was her silence, in a sense, because we don't hear her saying a lot of things, you know.
And when it comes to the Assumption, what is this saying for you?
The Assumption for me is what we have to look forward to, that whether the day is filled with the reality of suffering or joy, whether it's filled with questions, but this is going to be transformed, recreated. That's what happened to Mary. Through Christ's death, she was recreated. That's what it means for me. You know, that there's this promise, and Mary is a fulfillment of that promise already, and it's waiting for each one of us. For me, the Assumption is, or our Dormition, something to be looked forward to, that we're going to be in the hands of the Lord.
I was speaking there to Father Clyde Rausch, an oblate of Mary Immaculate.
Mary, soar to your wisdom on the wings of a dove.
Staying on the theme of the Assumption, let's now listen to a musical meditation focusing on this Marian feast by music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Assumpta est Maria in cenem, caret angelum, laudat.
Assumpta est Maria. Mary has been assumed into heaven. The angels rejoice. They sing for joy and praise the Lord. This is what we celebrate in the fourth glorious mystery of the Rosary. Christian art loves to depict the scene with Mary borne aloft by angels, while the disciples gasp with astonishment from earth below. And any text about rising to heaven is a gift for a composer. Listen to the joyful, surging scales in Giovanni Pierluigi da Palestrina's motet Assumpta est Maria. Palestrina's music has always been held up as a model of the most perfect form of Renaissance polyphony. He became something of a legendary figure in the 19th century among those who wanted to revive the sacred choral style of the 16th century. It's easy to see why. The classical purity of this intricate interweaving of voices seems to evoke the perfection of a bygone age, and at the same time, the glory of the world to come. For those of us living in Rome, the name Palestrina has a local ring because it's the name of a small town a short distance away, a good place to go for a day out of the city. Pope Julius III had been the Bishop of Palestrina before he was elected to the papacy, and when he moved to Rome, he brought with him his former cathedral organist, Giovanni Pierluigi. Unlike many Roman composers of the time, Palestrina was not a cleric. He was married with a family. In fact, an exception was made for him to sing in the Cappella Sistina, normally open only to celibates. He did consider entering the priesthood after his first wife died, but it was not to be, and in due course he married for a second time. The doctrine of Our Lady's Assumption has a long history, even though it was only in 1950 that it was solemnly defined as a dogma of faith by Pope Pius XII. It has a particularly venerable tradition in the Eastern churches. St. John Damascene, for example, wrote beautifully about the mystery. In the East, it's normally referred to as the Dormition of Our Lady. Let's listen now to a musical meditation on this theme for the unusual combination of string quartet and handbells, written by the living English composer John Taverner, himself a member of the Orthodox Church. It's called The Last Sleep of the Virgin.
And many thanks there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, music historian and rector of the Venerable English College in Rome, for that programme produced by Veronica Scaresbrick. And that's all we have time for in today's programme. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.